Okay, well, it's 11:45, so let's get started. Thanks, everyone, for coming along. My name's Nick Long. I'm one of the assistant professors of anthropology here in the department. So I'm a permanent member of staff, and I teach 3 or 4 courses for undergraduates and master's students. As you can see, the technology fairies have given us this strange, slightly yellow pall to the presentation. I promise that what's on my laptop is a gleaming white, but I'll have to make do with that. So what I'm going to do in the talk today, this is a picture from my own fieldwork of an Indonesian poet. You know, Indonesian poetry is very interesting in terms of how it's different from British forms of poetry, because the language itself is not very expressive or flowery, but the ways in which people emote the language becomes incredibly melodramatic. I'm not going to be quite so melodramatic, but what I am going to do is give you a little bit of an overview of what anthropology is. Some of you probably already have a very good idea of that, but sometimes people don't necessarily know, and it's worth finding out whether or not it's right for you. And linked to that, I'm going to go through the content of our undergraduate courses so you get a sense of what we actually teach you here. I'll talk a little bit about the experience of studying at LSE specifically and the things that make our course distinctive. And then to conclude my talk, which will be about half an hour, I'll give you a few kind of pointers as to the sorts of things that we're looking for in applications. I don't want to be too prescriptive, but just to give you a sense. And then we'll have about 15, 20 minutes for you to ask any questions that you might want to. So if we begin by thinking about what anthropology is and the kinds of things that you'll be reading about and writing about in your degree, one way of thinking about anthropology is the study of human beings, but that's very broad. What I would narrow that down to is the question of why do human beings live their lives in the ways that they do? There's so much variety in human societies, in human ways of life. How do we explain that variety? Are there commonalities between different human populations, between different human societies and cultures? If there are commonalities, what are they and how do we explain them? Is that because of biological innateness? Is it because of historical factors to do with imperialism or colonialism or capitalism? How do we make sense of the variation that exists despite these commonalities? So it's a deep inquiry into what it means to be human in general, but also what it means to be human in particular places at particular moments in time. And so it's this wonderfully, incredibly broad subject. Anything where human beings live their lives and are active in the world can be the subject of anthropological inquiry. So it can be the classic kind of Amazonian tribe where you look at shamanic rituals or tribal warfare and understand what's going on. That can be studied from an anthropological point of view. But anthropologists could also go to a physics lab and think, well, how do people make scientific knowledge? How do things get credible? When you look at something like the MMR autism, the MMR vaccine scandal, how did that happen? How could it be that so many people suddenly lost their faith in that piece of science? These are all the kinds of questions that an anthropologist can address. And hopefully use that to think about the changes that are taking place in society today. Why is it that we're seeing various trends of increasing rises of certain types of religious movement, for example? Or how are people coping with climate change? Why is it that a lot of people are worried about climate change and yet not really doing very much about it? You know, we're going to recycle our paper, so that's going to help climate change. Probably not going to, but nevertheless, that's what we do in response. How do we understand that? And how can we use the knowledge that we get as anthropologists to try and think about ways to make the world better? Those are all the kinds of issues that you'll be exploring in this degree. Now, the thing that's distinctive about an anthropological approach is the method that it uses. So here you see me doing some of my field work in Indonesia, and the point is that you go to the place where the people that you're interested in finding more about live and share their lives with them. And it's from that deep, immersive sharing of lives that you can get what I would say is a privileged form of insight that makes anthropology distinctive from other social sciences. So, you know, a sociologist can go and do a big survey and you get all the data of household composition, and that's useful for tracking certain kinds of trends, but it's not going to tell you what it's like to live as a member of that household. It's not going to tell you what it's like to cope with your kid getting disappointing results in their exams, how people respond to that. You've got to be there living it, experiencing it, sharing it with people. So this is, I'm learning how to do a traditional Malay dance, but not because I was working on dance. This was at an end of Ramadan feast in Indonesia, hosted by the mayor, this very popular mayor who'd been present for ruling the town for 17 years. And so she invites all of the members of the town to go to what's called an open house, or Rumah Terbuka, where people can meet her and chat to her and dance in her front garden and see her house. And by taking part in that, I could begin to understand a little bit about why people cared for that mayor so much, how she was able to use these events to make sure she stayed mayor for 17 years and had no credible opposition. By seeing their experiencing it, talking to people, engaging very deeply, you get a more privileged form of insight. So that's what we call an ethnographic methodology. It's based on long-term fieldwork, a method sometimes called participant observation. So I've spent 30 months working in Indonesia trying to understand political change, ghost beliefs, educational psychology. I mean, anything and everything that is important to people, I try and understand. Obviously, you wouldn't have to spend 30 months to do an undergraduate degree. But you will be reading the results of people who've had that very, very deep immersion. And so it's a very kind of personal, powerful approach. What it allows us to do is understand the social world from its members' point of view. That's something that other disciplines, we would say, struggle with. Sometimes you might have these rational choice models in political science. Well, but do people really think like rational actors? Well, sometimes, but not always. So you need to try and understand their point of view. That's not to say that you're just going to be peddling a kind of apologism, so-and-so says that this is what they do, therefore we should support it. You also need to think critically about how that point of view gets shaped. And that's where the more critical analytical side of anthropology comes in with this data harvesting. So what's made people think in that way? Is that to do with the way that ideology works on them? But if it is, then how does ideology actually work? Is it to do with the influence of economic factors? Is it to do with religious ideas? Is it to do with something that's fundamentally human, either something biological within us or a kind of existential anxiety that we have about where we're going in the world, the ways that humans tend to think? These are all the kinds of questions that you'll be exploring. So, as I hope you can see, it's a fantastic opportunity to engage with lots of the big questions that animate other fields, political theory, philosophy, sociology, but with that lived experience of real people right at the heart of inquiry. So it's often been said that anthropology is a form of philosophy with people in, a way of asking big questions about the way the world works, but without depersonalizing it and turning it into these big abstracted ideas, but really making it something very, very humanist. So if that's the discipline as a whole, how would you engage with it if you were here? Well, a lot of your first year will be spent doing things like this, drinking coffee, coping with, hopefully, books not quite as thick as that. Looks like it might be a law textbook, ours a little bit slimmer. But you'll be doing three anthropology papers in your first year. So one of them, AN100, is basically a broad introduction to what it is to be human. It's introducing you to key issues and themes in human life. Love. Is love universal? Do people everywhere have the same experiences of love and infatuation that we do? Might love be experienced really differently in some other parts of the world? That's a big debate. So those kinds of questions. Is everyone scared of their death? What makes people scared of death? That will be paired with a history of anthropological theory. One of the things we're very keen on and committed to in this department, is making sure that your inquiry is not just of looking at interesting, fashionable, contemporary things, but rooted in a really deep understanding of the intellectual history of social science. And that's something that LFC in general is very committed to. Certainly our anthropology department is. But it's not just a kind of doctrinaire, this is the history. The point is to introduce you to as many different theoretical perspectives as possible so that you can decide which ones you agree with, which ones you would use to answer the questions that matter to you. And so it's a very exciting exploratory course. And the final anthropology course in the first year is a kind of set text course, where you'll get six ethnographies focusing on particular societies that you get to explore in depth. Because all of this is very broad. We like to also pair that with a really deep, focused understanding of what it's like in various parts of the world. So we'll combine these set texts with films, sometimes with novels or fictional media, and ask how can we combine all these different forms of evidence to really understand and adjudicate debates about what are happening in contemporary societies. Final paper that you get to do in your first year can be anything that you like. It's an outside option, so if you've always thought you'd like to dabble with some philosophy or some international relations, have a go at some economics, or continue a language that you've been learning, start a new language, you can do that. And the way the first year assessment works, if one of the papers goes badly, that doesn't count for anything in terms of your final degree. So it's a real opportunity to just kind of explore, test the boundaries, and go with what you'd like to. So it's a great introduction to things. In your second year, you get more into depth in particular themes in anthropology. So we have a course called Kinship, Sex and Gender, which is trying to understand what families are, what makes people related, actually. It might seem very self-evident to do with blood or with genes, but is it so self-evident? If you've got an adopted child and a biological child and the building is burning, will you always rescue the biological child before the adopted child? That's, will you always love a biological child more or in a different way? These are big debates. It's not very clear. Most Americans would save their biological child before their adopted child, but elsewhere it's not quite so clear. If you look at individuals like this person here, this is Pang, who's a Kutoi. It's a Thai ladyboy. And so we might think, well, how do we understand this kind of third gender, someone that was born as a male but now has adopted a very stereotypically female disposition? And so Pang herself might say that she was born as a man, but her mind was female, so she wanted to craft herself as the Kutoi. But then her partner, a Middlesbrough man, views things slightly differently. He really likes being in a relationship with Pang because her body is so female and yet she's still got the mind of a man, and so he can really connect with her in a way that he feels he can't connect with women. So these different ways of reading and understanding this kind of gender situation shows some very interesting ways in which globalization and tourism are creating new forms of intimacy, new forms of relationship, but also tensions and precarities within those relationships. In fact, just to show how anthropological research can actually contribute to things like policy, one of the things that's very interesting in the UK and the US is that if you want to have a gender reassignment surgery, you're often forced to say, well, although I've been born as this gender, I really feel that in my soul, psychologically, I'm the other gender. Now, anthropological research with transsexuals has found that's often not actually what people experience. They feel something more like a composite. They want to experience themselves as transgender rather than as either male or female. But they're forced to try and claim that they really want to be female or that they really want to be male because that's what the medical system expects of them. So actually, by attending very closely to the real psychological life experiences of transsexual populations, which is something that ethnography and anthropology allows you to do, we're in a position to try and challenge that kind of medical institution to have slightly more compassionate and open-minded ways of thinking about gender reassignment surgery and what that might mean for people, so that someone who's obviously having a terrible time feeling they're in the wrong body doesn't have to jump through institutional hoops just because of what the medical sciences 20 years ago thought was gender. You also get to do a course in political and legal anthropology. So why do people obey the law? Is it because they're scared? You know, we'd all break the law now, no one would know. It would depend what we did. But if we did something very minor, we could break it, but we're not going to. We're good citizens. How's that happened? How have we been turned into those people that care about the law? What makes some forms of activism successful? Why do some people hate the police? Can you have social order without the army or the police to try and keep a state safe and controlled? Those are the kinds of questions that you'd investigate in political and legal anthropology. We'd look at ways in which order and authority were established in all sorts of societies and use that to reflect critically on what's actually happening in our own, as well as thinking about the processes of democratization, the Arab Spring, you know, how did that happen? Is it going to be successful? What challenges lie ahead for democracy in places like Egypt? How can we use anthropological perspectives to understand and overcome those challenges? Economic anthropology is often one of the subjects that applicants, oh gosh, it's the London School of Economics, is it very economics-y? But economic anthropology is actually really amazing, so I'm going to try and convince you in a couple of minutes that it's really amazing. So you do get to study the different kinds of exchange systems that exist around the world. What's the difference between a society based on exchanging gifts and ones that has a capitalist market? You also get to look at situations like this in Vietnam, where multinational corporations have come in, set up factories, huge numbers of women in Vietnam now working in these factories for quite low wages. How is that changing their lives? So I have a colleague in Sweden who did work in one of these factories, actually a factory in Indonesia. And he found that we often assume people want to take up this kind of job because it's better paid than a traditional livelihood and so forth. And maybe it is. But what he found was that model of economic push and pull factors and economic migration just wasn't enough. Because what would happen is people would get jobs that they hated. They were having a horrible time. They might lose their jobs. But they couldn't bear to tell their families back home that that's what had happened. They were too embarrassed, too ashamed. It was important that they return home as a successful migrant. When they were going back for holidays, they'd rent Rolex watches so it could look like they'd been big successes. And of course, then everyone thought, well, if you go to that island and work in that factory, you can make it big time. I mean, this guy, he was nothing special. Now he's got a Rolex watch. And so those human passions and motivations and feelings of shame and embarrassment actually fuel the migration just as much as a concern with getting cash. This is what I mean about understanding things from the person's point of view in a much more sophisticated way. If we think about economic anthropology, I've got an Apple laptop. I spent a lot of money on this Apple laptop just because it was Apple. Why did I do that? How have brands like Apple and Pokemon come to dominate the world? What is it about them that makes them exciting, that lead people everywhere to spend huge amounts of money and make executives in Silicon Valley very, very rich? It's also the kind of thing that economic anthropology would ask. Is it just because the laptop's really good? Or is it because all my friends have got a laptop and I feel I need to be like my friends? These are the kinds of debates that we would explore. In your third year, you have two core courses. You do a paper in the anthropology of religion. What is religion? If we look at something like the British Humanist Association, which one of my colleagues is working on, I mean, they have services and funerals and choirs, but they're atheists. So is atheism then a religion or not? What makes something a religion? This is another, it was very Vietnamese day, this is another shot from Vietnam, which was socialist, it still is socialist, but it banned religion for many, many years, and now there's been a tremendous revival of religious practice. How do we understand that? Why are certain types of charismatic Christianity or reformist Islam gaining ground in the contemporary world? And you also get to do a paper on advanced anthropological theory, which is a little bit like that set text thing that you did in the first year. It will be set text of particular advanced theory, so really understanding things like human suffering, human psychology and subjectivity, the nature of value, the nature of exchange, whatever the most cutting-edge issues are in the discipline at the time you're in that third year, you will be studying it. You also get to do some independent research, which is, I think, the most exciting bit of the whole degree. And we make you do two different projects. The first is an actual ethnographic project that you will do yourselves. And there's no question here of having to save up money to go and fly off somewhere very far away and very expensive in order to do this. So that it's fair and everyone can participate equally. You do it in London, but you can do it anywhere in London. So I had a student who did a project with bell ringers. Another person worked with bicycle couriers, looking at the way they navigated the city. All kinds of projects that you can do. And the advantage of doing it in London is that your research will run alongside classes and lectures and all forms of support that we provide. So you're doing this independent project, but we're right there to help you get through it, because we recognise that you've never done anything quite like that before, probably. And you also get to write a library-based dissertation on any question that really excites you, that you want to answer, you can tackle it. So that's the core program. And alongside that, we've got a whole host of options, including anthropology of selected regions. So a specialist in that area will teach you for 10 lectures all about the area that inspired them to spend their whole careers working in that part of the world. So I teach the Southeast Asia paper, but we have Amazonia, China, as you can see, all sorts. And we also have thematic options: anthropology and human rights, anthropology and media, the anthropology of childhood, cognition and anthropology, as you can see. Tremendous range, and there'll be 6 options to choose from any given year. So there's no risk that you'll end up doing something that you don't really want to. It's also possible to build on what you did in your first year and continue to take some outside options. So if you really enjoyed working at a language, you can continue to do that. It's not guaranteed. You have to fill in a form, and if the course is capped, there might be problems, but I've never heard of anyone being turned away from that. You can also borrow papers from SOAS, borrow papers from UCL, so if you're really interested in doing African literature paper, then you can do that. If you're really interested in doing some of the things at UCL in medical anthropology, you can borrow that, subject to approval from them. But as I say, very regularly our students get accepted. So that's a little bit about what you'll be studying. What will the experience of learning it be like? Well, we have quite a unique approach to teaching here at the LSE, because we have the traditional lectures, but what we then do is back them up with 2 different forms of student-supported learning. So you'll have weekly classes where 3 articles or book chapters will be set, and they'll relate directly to the issues that were brought up in the lecture. And you then get together in a group of about 12 students, normally 10 to 15 students, and the lecturer or a teaching assistant, and you'll discuss and debate those readings. So that's a great opportunity to consolidate your understanding. And it also means that over the course of the 2 terms, you've got a fantastically broad reach of anthropology, because you've been reading a little bit on every topic. That gets complemented with what we call tutorials, which are a small group, very small group, teaching environment, kind of one lecturer to 2 students, where you prepare an essay and then have to defend and discuss your argument. So it's a real opportunity to zoom in depth on things that you want to write about. You know, the classes, it's just whatever's set, but for the tutorials, you take the initiative, and we can give you that challenge to develop your argument, improve your writing skills, and really push those ideas as far as they can go. So I think the combination of that, very kind of adventurous, independent learning, and a broad base with lots of staff support makes us a very unique and very compelling teaching approach. And we provide all kinds of support services. We've got a departmental library, which gives you access to books that might be out on loan from the regular library. And that becomes a very nice, warm, common room space. And I do want to emphasise, we're a really friendly department. The LSE sometimes has a bit of a reputation as being cutthroat and heartless and competitive. And it might be that for a couple of the departments, I won't name names, but for a couple of the departments it might be a little bit like that. But with anthropology, really not. I mean, we have about 40 students. We get to know everyone very well through these tutorials and classes. Everyone's on first name terms. It's a very supportive, friendly learning environment. So that's the teaching method. What else makes LSE distinctive? Well, I would say that you'll get the best grasp of social anthropology anywhere in the UK. I'm quite confident in that assertion, although I'm sure I have colleagues elsewhere who disagree with me. The reason I say it is because we teach at such a high level. It's an advanced, challenging course. But you have that breadth and you have a focus on social anthropology all the way through, which even places like Oxford and Cambridge won't offer you. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we were ranked the best anthropology course in the country by The Guardian. I have to say it as part of my pitch. But you know, that's based on student satisfaction. It's based on the very good staff-to-student ratio. These league tables are always a little bit dodgy, but the fact is that we're highly ranked because we're good at what we do. But there are some things that you won't find at the LSE and that might mean that we're not quite right for you. So if you want to do any archaeology, or some deep inquiry into past societies, that's not something that we offer. We're a social anthropology department only, so we can't provide any teaching or tuition in that field. You also won't find any biological anthropology as such. I do want to qualify that claim, because one of the distinctive things about our department is that it's a pioneer in what's called cognitive anthropology. And this is trying to look at certain biological processes, neurological development, developmental psychology, processes of cognition, maybe evolutionary psychology, those kinds of biological perspectives, and thinking about how those approaches might be used to understand the patterns of thought that characterise life amongst us today. So that is a very biological perspective, but what you won't find is the fossil hominins, or that kind of human evolution story, or human anatomy that you might get at some other departments. So if you really want to engage with that material in depth, we're probably not the department for you. But if you're interested in thinking about how biological perspectives might illuminate social life, then we are a department you should consider, because this will be part of the core teaching, and there's also a whole series of options specifically on cognitive and psychological anthropology that you could take. So there'd really be an opportunity to specialise in that stream if you wanted to. One of the other programmes that we offer, as well as our regular social anthropology course, is the BA in Anthropology and Law. And it's worth considering this quite seriously if you have any interest in being a professional lawyer. Because you get to do seven law courses, you do seven law courses and five anthropology courses, that actually gives you all the law you need to go straight into your professional training as a barrister or as a solicitor. You wouldn't need to do the GDL or graduate diploma in law. So it's a qualifying course, which is very exciting. But it also is paired with all of this anthropology. So rather than doing loads and loads and loads of law and memorising all of these cases, you get a much broader degree. So you need to think whether or not that's an experience you'd enjoy. It can sometimes be a little bit schizophrenic. You've got to be able to think in two very different ways, because law is very much following cases, and anthropology is more about thinking outside the box and asking, well, how did this become the law anyway? But it is a very rewarding degree for someone who's got an interest in that legal process or is thinking about becoming a lawyer, wants to experiment with the two styles of learning. So you'll do the standard qualifying courses, which I think is European law, property, torts, I can't remember, the list is on the website. And then you'll do two introductory anthropology papers, a paper in political and legal anthropology, so you can really think about law from two points of view in that subject, and then some free choice of anthropology papers, either from our regular options or from the core courses. So you still have quite a bit of flexibility in terms of the anthropology component. Not so much flexibility in terms of the law if you want to qualify, but if you don't want to qualify, then you can have a lot more freedom in terms of which law papers you study. Now, it's often said that anthropology is not a very good degree in terms of getting a job. That's not strictly true. So in 2012, which is the latest year we've got data for, 87.2% of our graduates were either in employment or further study or taking deliberate time out just 6 months after graduation, which is not too bad. And their average starting salary was also quite good, £24,200. In the UK, not very many people study anthropology. So it brings you something a little bit different to the table when you're applying for a job. And it also provides you with very distinct skills. Because you're always thinking from the bottom up, you're thinking in terms of how things actually affect people and how they might affect different constituencies in different ways. That gives you a really kind of important kind of insight that works very well for professions like policy making, development policy, even working for a local authority or in the civil service. You'll get research skills, but also research skills actually working with people in their communities for that ethnographic project. And you get very advanced critical thinking. So these are all very, very useful skills. We find that many of our graduates want to go into further study, many want to go into charity work, local and national government, obviously law for the anthropology and law students, marketing, media, you know, these are things that are very, very popular. And again, something like marketing, if you've got an ability to understand how a product might be used, how a brand might capture people's imagination, the kind of anthropological perspective can help you do your job really, really well. So that's what we offer to you. What we're looking for from you is for our regular social anthropology programme, which can be a BA or a BSc. I mean, that's up to you. There's no difference. We would ask for an AAB set of grades at A-level. If you're doing the International Baccalaureate, 37 points with 666 at higher. And it's exactly the same for the BA in anthropology and law. Now, we're very flexible in terms of the subjects that you've taken. We know that anthropology is not taught at very many schools. People come to it from all kinds of routes. So we're not prescriptive in terms of what subjects you're taking. It's useful to have an essay writing subject because you're going to be doing so much writing as part of the degree. So if we can see that you're doing that at a high level, that's helpful. But it's not essential. We'd look at your GCSE grades and essay writing subjects. If we had any doubts, we might ask you to sit our entrance exam just to test that you could write an essay. So I wouldn't worry too much about your A-level choices eliminating you if you're straight sciences. What then really makes the difference is the personal statement. And I'll give you a few tips in terms of what's helpful for that. I mean, it seems very obvious, but it is important to show that you understand actually what anthropology is. And the best way to do that is by actually reading some anthropology. So I've got a list of suggested readings that you can look at that I'll give you at the end. Because we want to know, you know what you're signing up to. The last thing we want is to admit someone who looks very enthusiastic and then they realise they don't enjoy the subject and drop out after a term. That would be no good. So we want to see that you've done some reading, but we also want to see what you think about those readings. It's that process of reflection and your thought at work that we're really concerned about, much more than extracurricular activities or anything like that. So what's your opinion on these readings? How are they setting an agenda for things that you want to explore? In terms of the skills that we would like to see, are you good at understanding different people's points of view? How have you been able to do that? So sometimes we get personal statements of, I've been doing lots of travel. And if you've been doing lots of travel, that's great. But you can also look at people's points of view from contexts that are very familiar to you, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's often better than writing about travel because you know a lot more about what you're talking about. So I've seen some very good personal statements from people writing about volunteering in their local hospital and what that revealed about the healthcare system. A fantastic personal statement that was talking about the experience of being a waitress in Pizza Hut and how being an A-level student, you were treated really differently to being a university student by the customers, why that might be. So anything can be the route to showing that kind of understanding. But it is also, obviously, helpful to show that you're curious about the world beyond Britain as well, because you're going to be spending all of your degree learning about a great diversity of society. So we want that broad-based curiosity. If you're applying for anthropology in law, you will see that statistics make it look as if it's very, very competitive. It's something like 120 applications to 15 places. But the sad truth is that many people who could be very good students eliminate themselves by only talking about why they're interested in law and not talking about anthropology at all. So actually, it's not quite as competitive as it seems. So that means don't be put off, but also when you're writing the personal statement, find a way to talk about the intersection of anthropology and law. And there's all kinds of things that you could talk about in relation to that. What's your opinion on Sharia law? Should people be allowed to wear the burqa in the courtroom? When we look at these debates that are taking place around consent, you know, are current rape laws inherently misogynist and inherently discriminatory against rape victims? These are the kinds of things that bring together a legal perspective with a more anthropological perspective. And if you talk about some of them, issues of how should we deal with human rights abuses overseas, that will be very exciting for a law admissions tutor, but also for an anthropology admissions tutor. So that is my tip in terms of how to make your personal statement as successful as possible. So hopefully that gives you a little flavour of the kinds of things that we do, a little flavour of the kinds of things that we're looking for. And we've now got about 10 to 15 minutes left, so I would love to take any questions on any aspect of the degree or of the subject or of admissions, and I'll do my best to answer them. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could clarify a little bit about the optional modules, because it says in the prospectus that we get one, but only in the first year. But then, so what's the difference between the ones we can do all the way through and the modules?
Sure. So in the first year, you get an option from completely outside the department. In the second year and the third year, you get up to one unit for options, the papers of your choice. Now, that list of options that I was showing you, let me try and go back to it. It's going to take a long time. Each of them generally, here we go, counts for a half unit. So you'd be able to select two in any given year and total that up to the two outside units that you want to. And that, they're probably not listed in the prospectus or on the website, because what they are varies every year depending on who's around. We want to keep it fresh, so people are constantly coming up with new options that reflects what they're researching right at that moment in time. In terms of being able to take papers from outside departments in your second year and your third year, that won't be in the prospectus, because to do that you have to go through a procedure which is called suspending regulations, which sounds terribly transgressive and difficult, but it's very easy. It just involves filling in a form. And what that, basically the point is that if you're an anthropology student, you're pretty much guaranteed a place on any of these courses, because we run them. The only reason that might not happen is if you wanted to switch halfway through the term and the course was already full. But if you sign up on time, you're guaranteed to take the course. With papers in other departments, we don't have control over that, so there has to be an application process. But as long as you discuss it in good time and contact the teacher involved, there shouldn't be a problem. I mean, I, for example, had four students from outside departments taking my Southeast Asia option, had a philosopher, I had a geographer, I had someone in accounting, but he's got a Southeast Asian wife, so he wanted to know more about her background. And that was fine. So it's very easy to do. Yeah.
And what is the difference between a BA in social anthropology and a BSc? Is there a difference in terms of the degree? Or?
Not at all. So in terms of the content, absolutely the same. The only thing that is different is how you feel about it. If you want to graduate with a BA or a BSc, some people have a strong ideological preference. They think, well, we can't possibly say that anthropology is a science. And others think, we must say that anthropology is a science. Some are concerned about which will look better to prospective employers, although experience suggests there's really no difference in terms of how it looks to prospective employers. So just sign up for whichever one seems right to you. And if by the end of the degree you're like, oh, you know, God, I signed up for BSc, but I really wish I could graduate with a BA, that kind of transfer can be arranged very straightforwardly. So it's just go with your guts, I think.
Just follow up.
Yeah.
Which one do employers prefer?
I don't think there's any difference. I think it could be that in certain sectors there would be a difference. So I would imagine if you wanted to work in theatre, for example, BA in anthropology seems more familiar than BSc. And there might be a concern that BSc is going to be a sort of scientific, like forensic anthropology, like you do with CSI. That's another thing we don't offer, unfortunately. It'd be really cool, but we don't. In that particular sector, it might make a difference. But I think for most employers, if you're just looking at a general graduate scheme or the civil service, they wouldn't really have a preference. It would be much more significant what the grade was in the degree and the references, because I mean, many subjects are inconsistent in terms of what's graded as BA or BSc across the country. So I think only if you really wanted to target the arts, then it might be advisable to go for a BA.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify on your question, because based on what I know and based on the places that I've looked at and volunteer places that I've been at, a BSc would help you more with, the scientific stuff, and definitely with like anthropology and law. But that doesn't mean a BA won't get you a job either, and it doesn't relegate you to just theater studies or whatever. Because I know a whole bunch of my tutors used to teach me. They're now in marketing, and in marketing they really do look for the BA instead of the BA. Instead of the BSc, because in the Bachelor of Arts degree, they kind of like see it as, if you study the arts, you kind of know what people want. Okay, we're going to try and get you to sell stuff to people so we make more money.
Yeah, exactly. But as I say, this isn't something that should be causing you to lose a lot of sleep now, because when you're deciding in the third year, this is the career that's for me, and if it seems that's going to be in a sector where the choice of BA or BSc might make a difference, then you can switch if you want to. So we're very flexible on that. There was a question here, and then at the back.
For the dissertation, is there a certain amount of words, or does that change every year?
It's 8,000 words for a dissertation, which is not too bad. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but you'll fill it up really quickly.
If you're considering doing the anthropology and law, and you're interested in maybe going into doing law with human rights and that kind of side of law, do you think doing anthropology with law is more of an advantage than just studying the law course, I say?
I would say so. I guess I have to say that I would say so. I think the advantage that you get from anthropology is being able to understand the context of any kind of human rights issue much more. We've got a course on human rights, so if that were running, and it probably will be because it's very popular, that allows you to think about human rights issues from a different way, and the kind of jurisprudence issues over what you decide ought to be a human rights abuse and what ought not to be. You'll gain a lot from learning that from an anthropological perspective. And if you were just doing the general LLB, it would be possible, I think, to take one option in human rights law, and that would be very useful. But of course, you could still audit that if you were here. It's another thing I should have mentioned, that you're free to audit or attend the lectures of any course that's running in the school. A lot of them get recorded and put up online, so even if there's a timetable clash, you can watch them and get that information. But of course, that would only be one unit that you were doing, and then you'd have all of this other law material that wouldn't be so relevant. So I think in terms of opening your mind and coming up with new ways of thinking about the issues that are at stake, I think it would be very helpful. I mean, I'll give you a concrete example. I have a friend who's a human rights barrister, and she's very big on the issue of fighting for gay rights in places like Uganda or places across the world where there aren't very good gay rights. And obviously that's something that we should support. But sometimes the language in which that's put forward can itself be quite problematic, because by framing the issue as one about gay rights or gay identities and that kind of sexuality as an identity, you might actually be fighting for something which is quite different to the locally understood sexual practice, which often might lead to people have wives, they identify as normal men, but they also have sexual relations with men. That's not very well captured in the LGBT rhetoric, because that's not the way that LGBT identities play out here. So sometimes the human right that you ought to be fighting for in America and the human right that you ought to be fighting for in Uganda might not be quite the same, but that human rights law training doesn't necessarily equip you to think about those complexities as well as an anthropological training in things like kinship, sex and gender would. So I think it would bring a lot to the table. Yeah.
How would you guys compare your curriculum to that of NSSR's? Because I understand from NSSR, because they are based in New York, they focus a lot on urbanism and urban tribalism, et cetera, et cetera. And you yourself, you said you studied and done ethnographical work in Southeast Asia, which happens to be where I'm from, but that's regardless. How much of the course is actually focused on, say, urban anthropology?
Well, we don't have, as yet, an option in urban anthropology, although we do have a new member of staff who worked on city planning in East Berlin, so I think that option might well be coming up very soon. You'll be engaging with urban contexts throughout the degree, but it would be woven into the structure of things that we've been looking at so far. So there might be questions of, does the experience of living in a city change people's proclivities for religious behaviour? That might be a topic that you'd look at in religious anthropology. You might look at how does city planning work? We get cities like Milton Keynes. They're supposed to be utopias, but people don't enjoy living there. How should we understand that? But that would be part of political anthropology. So we've got a very kind of broad base in terms of our teaching. But as I say, if you were to want to engage more with urban materials, you could do that for your tutorial essays, if that's a particular area of interest for you. And we've got a cities program housed in the geography department, so it would be possible to take some of the cities and urban geography material as outside options if you wanted to. But I wouldn't say that we have an urban concentration. I'd say we're quite diverse, and so there will be urban materials coming up, but compared to somewhere like NSSR, probably less than their program offers.
That said, though, I know ethnography like change every year, and the syllabus obviously changes every year, and anthropology being such a dynamic subject, ethnography tends to change a whole lot. But for now and for the upcoming, say, semester, so what are the six key ethnographies that are currently in AN 102?
So the current six ethnographies, so an ethnography called With Respect to Sex, which is about eunuchs in India. There's an ethnography called Raining the River, which is about pollution and environmentalism in Nepal. There's an ethnography called Warring Souls, which is about nationalism in Iran. There's an ethnography called The Newer, which is a classic from 1940, which introduces you to that old school style of anthropology. And that's then paired with the fifth text, which is called Newer Dilemmas. And that looks at the experience of contemporary experiences of warfare and civil war in Sudan in the same context as that newer ethnography. And then the final one is a book called Remotely Global, which is about the experience of village life in post-colonial Togo. So those are the six that are running this year. But they're chosen to reflect the interests of the teachers who are changing year in, year out. But that gives you a sense of what's on offer here. As you can see, they're quite diverse. We try and make sure you encounter a range of contexts and topics. Yeah.
Would you expect someone to have done geography?
No, we have no expectations. So
someone with physics, chemistry and biology could easily apply.
Yeah, I mean, that's more or less what I did. I didn't do physics, I did maths instead. But yeah, that would be no problem. But what we want to look for in a personal statement is interest or clear interest in these broader social questions. So whether that be through engagement in charity work or in debating social issues or in drama or whatever, and we would look for an ability, proven ability in essay writing in GCSEs. As I say, if there was someone that were very, very sciencey, had a promising personal statement, but the GCSE grades for the essay-based subjects were all quite poor, then what we might do if we were really interested is say, well, it's looking good, but we need a bit more information. Come and sit our entrance exam, and then if that candidate did well in the written components, then we'd make an offer.
And are your tutorials week? Is it a weekly tutorial, or is it only...
It's fortnightly in the first year, and after that, three a term, so every 3 weeks.
Yeah. Thinking about year three, the research that you do, you know, two pieces.
Yeah.
Say a student gets to year three and they go really struggling, they can't think of an area that they would like to discuss. Mm. How would you guide them?
Well, I would... I mean, they'd come in as the academic advisors for tutorials, or they could meet any member of the department they felt comfortable talking with in office hours. I suppose what I'd ask them might be what excited them about anthropology when they began. Often it's helpful to go back to that very first kind of seed of the big question that people really hoped that they would be able to answer, and they might get distracted by things in the meantime. But, well, actually, that seems to be where your heart lies. Ask them what they found interesting and why. What are the things that they've enjoyed the most? Because it's often not to do with, I mean, the issue of the struggle and the intellectual support. We can provide tuition support for that. So it's about helping them realise what they want to do, which can be difficult because, I mean, with no disrespect to anyone taking A-levels, the A-level approach doesn't encourage people to be independent learners. And sometimes it's quite hard to know what you want to do. So for the dissertation, I suppose, I'd look for that kind of spark. And hopefully by that time, I would already know the student a little bit, so I could prompt them. I'd be like, well, I noticed that you really enjoyed, or you were very active in this particular seminar. That seemed to speak to you. What was it about that that you found interesting? And through that, try and guide them to some literature that they might enjoy engaging with and see if that works for them. And if it doesn't, then think again. So that would be for the dissertation. For the actual ethnographic research project, that's a little bit trickier in some ways because there's also the question of how they navigate access. If they're really interested in doing the study of the Royal Corps or the Old Bailey, that might not be possible. But then on the other hand, I mean, it can be about anything. And once you get into those relationships with your research participants, the interest kind of comes from that human contact. So as long as they are able to get a foot in the door, like often people begin, I'm not really sure how this is going to go, I've got a lot of doubts, but once they're a couple of weeks into it, they wouldn't change it for the world, because they find themselves captivated by all these stories of, you know, old ladies and their life histories, or, you know, people who've got passions about hobbies and things. It's very infectious, and everyone's got a story to tell. And the great thing about meeting an anthropologist is it's someone who's willing to listen to that story non-judgmentally. And even in London, where everyone's so kind of cutthroat and hard-bitten, supposedly, actually, that's a very welcome intervention. So we've never had any problems with students struggling to find a research site. Any other questions that I can help you with? Yeah?
I know you mentioned anthropological theory, but... Mm-hmm. Considering how large the anthropological imagination is, obviously we'll be exposed to both, but how in depth would we be looking at theoretical perspectives in particular?
Well, you can't really study any of this material without having a theoretical perspective.
Yeah, of course.
And the point of the teaching is to tease out what that perspective might be and to debate it, but with reference to particular areas of discussion. So you'll find it's a very in-depth approach. So, for example, in the kinship, sex and gender course, which I teach, every week we look at different ways of understanding what's going on. So almost layers of understanding sex and gender relations. So if we brought in a psychoanalytic perspective, what would that illuminate? If we brought in a more postmodern perspective, what would that illuminate? If we brought in a traditional structuralist approach, would that have anything still to offer? So it's theoretically rigorous, but still empirically focused. And that then allows students to concentrate more on the theory or more on the empirical materials according to them.
When I looked at the perspective of anthropology at A-level, there wasn't much theoretical I'm not doing this.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a theoretically challenging degree. And when you look at some of these optional courses, I mean, some of them are more theoretically ambitious than others. But the aim is, there are many different ways of being an anthropologist, and the aim is for you to chart your own course, and we have diverse courses, so there's something for everyone.
Would you say that LSE has a certain sort of aim, well, not an agenda per se, but a sort of, a certain, or like amongst yourselves in the anthropology department, a certain view or personal, personal preference as to which theoretical perspectives fit the best or fit the most? Because I know NSSR is very left-leaning, and that's why I've been looking towards NSSR. And I haven't really managed to look at LSE, and the way I see a lot of British universities, they tend to try and distance themselves and seem pretty neutral about it. And I understand that that's part of the culture and everything, but NSSR is very vocal about its study of, say, post-structuralism, postmodernism, and neo-Marxism.
Well, we certainly don't have an agenda in that sense, because we want students to hear the whole debate and make up their own minds. Broadly, we'd say we're quite probably a vaguely leftist department. I mean, we have on our staff David Graeber, who was behind the Occupy movement and is sort of anarchist philosopher of capitalism. On the other hand, we have people who are doing work on cognitive anthropology, which is fairly politically neutral. I would say there is no real theoretical agenda that we push, or as a whole. Certain professors have their own views, of course, other than a commitment to really anchoring work in participant observation in the lives of people and making it very empirically rich and rigorous, which unfortunately some universities don't do so much. And that's a commitment that we share, because it's that human experience that is what really matters. But beyond that, anyone can flourish in our department. So on that note, I think I see restless, hungry faces, so I'll let you all go on to the next phase of your day. Have a fantastic time. If you'd like...